This is an ABC podcast.
Can you catch COVID twice? You would have heard it maybe from a mate, a family member, maybe even you've said it yourself. Nah, I'm all good because I've already had COVID. So why are some people reporting catching COVID for a second time less than a month after they first had it? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you on Hack, and we're going to ask the experts what's going on. But on to that big texting scandal, which has blown up big time after another chaotic weekend in Canberra.
Hack.
A horrible, horrible person.
In that environment, you've got to get people who get along and people who don't get along.
What people say in text messages, frankly, doesn't matter anything.
On Triple J.
Leaked text messages, bitchy gossip, denials. The last week in federal politics has been full of drama that honestly makes high school seem pretty tame. Remember last week when a text message was leaked calling the Prime Minister a psycho, and it apparently came from one of his own ministers? Well, now there's been an allegation it was the Defence Minister, Peter Dutton. He's flat out denied it. And then there were the other leaked texts that blew up over the weekend from Deputy PM Barnaby Joyce, also slamming Scott Morrison. So what is going on? Are we about to see some kind of a leadership challenge? In a minute, we're going to ask those questions, but first, here's Joe Lauder to bring you up to speed.
This all started last week at the press club when Network 10 journo Peter Van Onselen caught the Prime Minister by surprise with a question about a text he'd been given between a current federal cabinet minister and former New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian.
In one, she described you as, quote, a horrible, horrible person, going on to say she did not trust you and you're more concerned with politics than people. The minister is even more scathing, describing you as a fraud and, quote, a complete psycho.
So awkward. It turns out the texts are 2 years old, from around the time of the bushfires. And while everyone wants to know who the minister is that called Morrison a psycho, no one has owned up to it yet. And no one's admitted to leaking the texts either. Then last night, the former New South Wales Labor Premier, Bob Carr, absolutely set the internet on fire by pointing the finger at Peter Dutton.
That is Bob Carr outing Peter Dutton as the leaker of the Morrison psycho texts.
Don't forget the Defence Minister Peter Dutton lost to Morrison in the leadership spill in August 2018. But Dutton already denied last week that it was him.
No, I'm a Queensland Cabinet Minister. I'm not a New South Wales Cabinet Minister. And there's doubt about all aspects of this.
And he's since tweeted to say that Bob Carr is wrong.
Peter Dutton's made it very clear that that's a baseless allegation. The tweet should be deleted.
But Bob Carr hasn't deleted it. He's doubled down this morning and said if Peter Dutton wants to prove him wrong, well, the guilty person should just fess up instead. Since then, government ministers have been out and about playing down the drama, like Treasurer Josh Frydenberg.
Well, Bob Carr was a waste of space as a foreign minister, and now he suffers from a bad bout of relevance deprivation syndrome.
And Communications Minister Paul Fletcher.
I think it's always unfortunate when political journalists want to focus on soap opera type aspects and who said what about whom.
But the Nationals Party, that's the party in government alongside the Liberals, also got in on the bitchy texting drama, and a message from their leader, Barnaby Joyce, about the PM also got leaked.
The Australian quotes Mr. Joyce saying, "He and Mr. Morrison don't get along. He is a hypocrite and a liar from my observations, and that is over a long time. I've never trusted him and I dislike how he earnestly rearranges the truth to a lie."
Barnaby was a backbencher at the time of the texts, but he's come out and apologised for what he said, and he offered his resignation to the PM.
I should never have written the text that I did. I certainly never expected the text to be forwarded on, and I don't blame anybody but myself, but I never expected it to end up in the public realm.
Today, the deputy leader of the Nationals, David Littleproud, played it down.
Barnaby obviously wanted to show his contrition and offered his resignation to the Prime Minister. It's actually only the National Party party room that accepts that. We're a different party to the Liberal Party, and we hold that sovereignty very dear. But we'll have a conversation with Barnaby, and he's always very candid, and so too are our party room meetings.
But Michael McCormack, the guy who used to be Deputy PM and leader of the Nationals, left the door open to coming back in as leader if Barnaby was to step down.
He's got some explaining to do. I appreciate many of our members are disgruntled about the focus on personalities, not on the people we serve. And I think we need to get back to earning that trust of those people we do serve.
So if the Deputy Prime Minister can't trust the Prime Minister, why should Australians?
Of course, this is an election year and it could be as close as 3 months away. And this is all great for Labor leader Anthony Albanese.
The issue here is that this is such a distraction. The dysfunction and the dishonesty and the disunity is meaning this government is paralysed in taking the action that really does concern Australians.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J.
Joe Lauder with that update. And let's get a bit of analysis on all of this now. Jade Gailberger is a federal political reporter at the Herald Sun and she's with us now. G'day, Jade.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, I'm well, thank you. It's pretty busy for you, though, in Canberra, I would imagine. Do you reckon we could see Scott Morrison rolled before the election?
No, I don't. I think there was a few kind of rumours flying around, and even though Scott Morrison has had a pretty bad summer in terms of rapid antigen test shortages, you know, workforce shortages, supermarket shelves being empty, I don't think this will be the end of him yet.
And what about Barnaby Joyce? Because it seems like for a little while there, for a minute over the weekend, people were talking about Scott Morrison's leadership, then they were talking about Barnaby Joyce's leadership. It seems that there are some people in the Nationals who are pretty angry about this distraction that is caused by these comments he made.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. I mean, the Nats are not shy in often airing their grievances, but I think one of the strong things about the Nats is that they're able to have these conversations in-house and then just move on and get on with business. So essentially lots of the Nats politicians were annoyed at Barnaby over the weekend because there was reports that he had offered the PM his resignation after the leaked text revealed that he called the Prime Minister a liar and a hypocrite. One of the reasons that the Nats were pretty angry about that is because they choose who the leader is of the Nationalist Party, not the Prime Minister. He doesn't choose who the leader is. So they're a bit annoyed about that because essentially Barnaby is accountable to them. So they were having a meeting today where they were going to discuss some of their grievances with Barnaby, but they felt pretty confident that they would be able to work through those.
So, Jade, are we any closer to finding out who this mystery MP was, who was allegedly slagging Scott Morrison out in these text messages with Gladys Berejiklian? Like, there's a lot of allegations that are flying around Twitter and the media and all other places. Do you think we'll find out?
That is a great question. I mean, journalists, are pretty good at keeping their sources quite secretive. So if only PVO would tell us. The Prime Minister doesn't believe that the leaker is in his cabinet. I mean, obviously we saw, Twitter just blow up last night with Bob Carr's tweets. But yeah, I think we're all waiting.
And the government, I mean, I would imagine would be hoping this speculation will die down, but, I mean, Labor's probably jumping on it. Is that what we've seen so far?
Yeah, Labor are definitely leaving the coalition to kind of blow up amongst themselves. There's not really much they have to do right now other than sit back and grab the popcorn. But I think they're just letting this all unfold and just, pointing out the fact that it's a distraction from the real job, which is still the COVID pandemic and getting on with that kind of recovery.
There's a few other things that were announced today, big kind of announcements. The government said for the first time in almost 2 years, Australia is going to reopen its border to international visitors later this month. Was that announcement expected?
Yeah, we expected it over the weekend, but I think the timing of it has definitely, been welcome by the tourism industry. They've obviously been crying out for support, some of those tourism operators where, they rely on international tourism over domestic travellers. The number of Aussies finally getting back up to North Queensland and enjoying some of those things, just it's not enough in comparison to, the waves of tourists that you used to get going to experience things like the Great Barrier Reef and some of those like warmer places. So this is definitely welcome, especially for all those tourism operators, for all those international visa holders to finally be able to come back and all these tourists.
Another interesting thing was the government also confirming that it's not going to be introducing legislation for a National Integrity Commission before the election. That seemed to, be an election promise. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's funny. So Scott Morrison held a presser maybe about 2 hours ago and he kind of made the point that it's like the term is not over. So essentially we were all under the impression that, you know, there's only a few sitting days left and it's going to be pretty hard to get something so contentious passed, given they've already got a lot on their plate in regards to religious discrimination bill. So the Anti-Corruption Commission has previously been, you know, accused of not having enough teeth, but Scott Morrison has said the term's not over just in this next fortnight. So he's leaving a pretty small window if he wants to actually introduce it, mind attempt getting it passed.
And then, as you mentioned there, there's the religious discrimination bill as well, which the government's keen to get passed, but they've got all of this resistance from people, you know, within their own ranks as well. So what's the update there?
Yeah, so quite a few moderate Liberals are essentially threatening to sink the bill because they're just saying they fear it goes, like, too far in actually enshrining some of the protections for those religious beliefs. They're worried that it could also infringe on existing discrimination laws. So some of them have also raised concerns that, you know, the right of religious schools to expel gay students, those protections there aren't in place. So there's currently some changes underway to the legislation, but nobody has seen what those amendments are yet and what the government is actually going to scrap and try and appease so that they can get this legislation through. But it also means that Labor has pretty much reserved their position until they see the final amendments. So it's making the next few days probably going to be pretty messy.
Yeah, I reckon it's going to be pretty busy for you guys in the press gallery as well. And not only the next few days, the next few weeks and months ahead. So Jade Gaelberger from the Herald Sun, really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us on Hack today.
No worries.
Hack.
I just couldn't believe that I had tested positive twice within a month.
On Triple J.
Yeah, a lot of you spent at least some of your summer stuck inside with COVID. It sucked. Hopefully it was relatively mild and now you're recovering okay. But imagine getting COVID twice in a month. It has happened to some people, maybe to you. Let me know, 1300 055 36. But how common is it? And how much protection do you have from reinfection once you've had COVID? Our reporter, Ellie Grounds, who's recovering from COVID herself, wanted to find out.
I was just like, oh my God, are you serious? Like, this is how I'm starting out 2022. I really thought I'd left at least my COVID experience behind.
Priya Adams-Williams got COVID-19 at her best friend's hen's party in Melbourne at the end of November. She thought that was her time with COVID done and dusted. Turns out she was wrong.
So yeah, I had it twice within 8 weeks, which most people that I tell that to are like, I didn't realise that was possible. Like, yep, neither did I. So here we are.
Priya was diagnosed with Delta the first time, and in early January got what she presumes was Omicron.
It really just felt like a bit of a, oh, here we go again. Because my symptoms with Omicron were just a lot milder, I was able to work through it, which was great.
So what is going on here? Can we get COVID twice?
So it's unusual, and so it just depends on the individual.
That's Professor Nigel McMillan. He's an infectious diseases expert at Griffith University in Queensland.
So if you're immunocompromised, then reinfection with a new variant like that certainly could occur. But generally, for a young, healthy person, you're going to have good, solid protection against the virus for at least 6 to 12 months.
Professor McMillan says Priya, who has a couple of autoimmune issues, is super unlucky to have contracted Omicron so soon after having Delta, but reckons for most young people with no other health conditions, it shouldn't be a problem. And what about those of us who managed to avoid COVID until getting Omicron over the summer?
Basically, if you were not vaccinated and you got the disease, you're going to have really good protection for at least 6 months, certainly probably 12, but six for sure. If you were vaccinated and then still got infection, you're going to be super covered for at least 12 months. So vaccination plus infection means you've really made you'll have a tremendous immune response.
Kit Harvey started his 2022 at a festival with friends.
I knew it was a risk to go to this live event, but I deemed it worth it. And I tested positive a couple of days later.
He says he got totally rolled by the virus. Really bad body aches and headaches and an extremely sore throat. He felt fine to leave isolation after 7 days, but says he's experienced fatigue and vertigo ever since. And then yesterday, he woke up just feeling like total crap.
I woke up with body aches, sort of more than the normal delayed onset muscle stuff you can get from playing sport. And I did a rapid antigen test, a saliva test, and it came back very strong double bar positive. So that was disconcerting.
He ended up doing a nasal RAT and a PCR test, which both came back negative. So turns out he doesn't have COVID again. Kit reckons he's feeling so average because he didn't take the time to properly rest and recover from the virus.
I just think I made a bit of a mistake in thinking that I could go straight back to life as it was before I had COVID. I didn't think that the long COVID, or I mean, a month isn't so long, but I didn't think that the lasting effects would really happen to me. And I guess I was ignorant in that regard.
Professor McMillan says Kit's probably picked up a completely different viral infection.
And look, I certainly have know personally at least three young, under 30s, who have had classic COVID symptoms. In fact, gone to the emergency room and the doctors have said, you've got COVID for sure. I don't even need the test, but we need to do it. And they've come back negative, three of them. And so there certainly are viruses, some are cold and flu-like viruses that go around and are going around at the moment.
Whatever the reason for his symptoms returning, Kit wants everyone who's had COVID recently to look after themselves and know that just because you're young, it doesn't mean you're invincible.
I feel pale and I feel a bit kind of lackluster just in terms of vitality. I've got friends that feel and frankly look the same. And I think it's something that we all kind of thought that maybe wouldn't apply to us. A little bit of maybe that immortality kind of complex that a lot of young people have. I can safely say that I was wrong.
Hack on Triple J.
Ellie Grounds with that story, and some of you getting in touch talking about ongoing COVID that you've been dealing with. Also, others who've said you've had COVID twice. Ash is one of those. Ash, what's been your experience?
Hi. So I've actually just got out of isolation for the second time after having COVID. So it was less than 2 weeks later that I tested positive again, after recovering and feeling pretty good in between. I started feeling quite ill again, same kind of symptoms. And I thought, oh, you know what, I better check again because, you know, this is classic COVID symptoms. But I thought, nah, surely not. It can't be, right? I should have the immunity, especially with vaccinations. But it tested positive.
That's crazy, yeah, Ash. You must have been like, what is this nightmare going on? And so many people are the same. They think, oh, it can't be that because I just had it. Are you obviously assuming that the first time you had Delta and then you got Omicron?
Honestly, I have no idea. I was hoping a PCR would help to identify that, but when I went to try and line up for a PCR, they said, no, you essentially don't qualify. You're not a healthcare worker. We can only give you a RAT. So we'll never know, I guess.
Wow. So many people with similar experiences. Ash, thanks for calling in, and hopefully you're feeling a lot better soon.
Hack. Groceries delivered within a period of 10 to 15 minutes. It's changing the way we can shop.
On Triple J.
You know, I really hate going to the supermarket. Like, honestly, I'll put it off for as long as I can. And then as soon as I get in there, I'm trying to get out. And if you're like me, you've probably seen all of those new apps that have popped up. They're basically like Uber Eats for groceries. You put your order in and then someone delivers them on a bike not long after. And they've really taken off during COVID, with people less keen to head out into crowded supermarkets. Maybe you've switched to online grocery shopping or you're using these new apps. Let me know, 1300 055 536. So I'm wondering, what is the future of supermarkets? And is this new convenience for us just going to create even more underpaid gig workers? Here's Ange McCormack.
A Woolworths or a Coles is built like a casino for a reason, right? They want you to wind through every aisle and see every product because that's how they do things.
I reckon you could talk to Mark Heath about supermarket shopping, of all things, for hours. He's the owner of one of those new on-demand grocery delivery apps. It's kind of like Uber Eats, but for bananas and milk instead of pad thai from down the road.
We have electric bikes. We do things in 15 minutes. So press the button to your door, 15 minutes.
Mark's company, Volley, isn't the only one doing this. Businesses like Milkrun, Send, Quicko, Aircart, Instacart, Geezy, They're all hustling to get in on this new trend of people wanting their stuff delivered pretty much instantly. Mark and other company bosses in this space are banking on people using their apps because of two big reasons.
One of them is shopping locally.
And the other one...
I think we've all just gotten so busy, you know, that everybody's trying to find a way to get an edge on an extra hour in their day. And now technology's got to the point where that's something we can actually do and wrap into our lives.
Obviously, there's a catch. There's delivery fees. Their range isn't as broad as a big supermarket. And generally, the stuff's a bit more expensive. But apps like Voli basically count on their customers to deal with that because they're kind of lazy.
I think it's also harking back to a fantasy of servant labour, a time when wealthy families could outsource key reproductive and domestic labour of the home onto other people.
This is Lauren Kelly from RMIT. If Mark could talk about supermarkets for hours, Lauren could talk about them for years, and she kind of does. Lauren's writing her PhD on supermarkets and supply chains in Australia.
Before COVID, the thought of buying groceries online was a little bit novel and a little bit strange. Most people don't have that preference because a lot of people are very fussy, especially about their fresh produce. They like to pick it themselves.
Lauren says this is all part of a broader trend towards personal services or servant labour that she mentioned before. It's stuff like getting your takeaway delivered, hiring an air tasker to build something for you, or even just booking an Uber to be your personal chauffeur. Lauren says these on-demand grocery apps talk a pretty big game, but the major supermarkets probably don't have heaps to worry about.
They say they're the new kids on the block and they're going to take on the supermarkets, but that's absolutely not what's going on and not a possibility. I don't think anyone can give Coles or Woolworths a run for their money. Maybe Amazon, if Amazon in Australia started getting into grocery.
What does concern Lauren, though, is how workers will be impacted if these businesses get even bigger. While some of the apps do hire their riders as employees, these types of apps often operate in the gig economy, which doesn't have a great track record for workers. Plus, Lauren says the popularity of on-demand groceries could have a pretty big impact on us socially.
These apps try to invisibilise that uncomfortable social relation by rendering the person who actually does the work invisible. You never see them. And now it's about contactless delivery, so you can have them just put it at your front door, for example, without even knocking. And there are features, for instance, in the back of an Uber, you can ask them not to talk to you, things like that.
Mark, who owns that grocery business I mentioned before, says he thinks apps like his are here to stay, especially for people who want to do exactly what Lauren said, outsource a daily task that feels like a chore.
People are realising they'd rather spend their time on more meaningful things than standing in the middle of a grocery shop.
Hack Triple J.
Ange McCormack with that story, and we're going to chat a little bit more about this now. We're going to talk to Dr. Caleb Goods. He's an expert on the gig economy and he's at the University of Western Australia. Caleb, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
So many parts of our lives are now serviced by the gig economy, things like Ubers, air taskers, now groceries. How much bigger do you think the gig economy is going to get?
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer. And I mean, the short answer is we've got no idea, but I mean, food delivery services have mushroomed to well over $150 billion US dollar industry globally and are expected to keep growing. We've seen food delivery grow by over 200% in Australia since the pandemic started. And obviously, the story mentioned, you know, the pandemic, needing to isolate, stay at home, not go to restaurants. I mean, that I think has really helped push us towards that kind of economy and the convenience factor. And we know that around 7% of Australians have either worked in the gig economy or tried to find work in the gig economy. So it's something that's growing and those stats kind of reinforce that point. But the sustainability of the gig economy is the question that people always ask, because those big companies that you've all probably heard of are still not turning a profit, basically. So the long-term future, I think, of the gig economy is something that's very much up in the air.
Interesting. Well, a lot of us probably want to use the apps for convenience, but there's always that ethical question about how workers are being treated, for instance. From what you've seen, has that been a big priority for these new startups?
Yeah, it's interesting. And as the story mentioned, you know, those food delivery apps and the rideshare services, you know, you can earn as little as $10 to $12 an hour, which is well below the national minimum wage, obviously. And there's been, you know, deaths and injuries associated with work. So there's a lot of sort of ethical questions and legal questions. And some of them actively try and make the consumer aware that they themselves don't think they're part of the gig economy. So I think one of the platforms, Milk Run, I think it is, has on its website that we are not part of the gig economy and that we employ our workers, right? So there's, I think they're trying to avoid getting sucked into the, to being labeled gig economy and exploitative and that sort of slave kind of argument, which is really interesting, I think. So some of them are actively seeking to avoid that tag and saying they're going to pay people properly. Others, you know, are still using the contractor model. I guess even if they're using the employment model, what award are they paying people under? And, you know, I've been told that some of them are using the miscellaneous award, which is basically the worst award we have in Australia, and it's for people who are uncategorised. Whether that's actually, you know, legally should be the case is another question. And then one that they don't really address is the promise of the deliveries in 10 minutes, right? So that's, you know, the platforms are sort of advertising convenience, even if they're using, you know, employees. But that time pressure has big impacts. You know, it impacts people to take risks, which means they're more likely to have accidents. So I think we have to be really conscious of, you know, this idea of getting my groceries in 10 minutes through my app and not having to interact with anyone. You know, that raises some, I think, ethical and workplace health and safety questions as well.
Yeah, interesting. We've actually got someone on the line, Luke from Silverdale. Luke, you are a delivery rider. What's been your experience?
Yeah, so I'm a delivery driver. Am I allowed to say which company?
Oh, probably steer clear.
We do rideshare and food and other stuff, so you can guess from that.
Yeah,
I've done delivery at this point for all of the big food delivery companies, mm-hmm. and this one that I'm doing with now. My initial concern was, hold on, I'll get back in the car. It's loud outside. my initial concern was the hourly rate would be low, but I'm consistently making like 35, 40 an hour. Of course, I have to take petrol out of that as well. And I'm as a contractor, so it's tax. It's before tax as well.
But I'm
still making in the gig economy after I finish my 9-to-5 job. I'm making more than 1.5 times what I do in my 9-to-5.
Interesting. Well, Luke, thanks for that. And it's kind of goes to some of the points that Caleb was discussing before. Caleb, what kind of changes do you think we're going to see in the future? Do you reckon the brick-and-mortar shops that we're used to now will become a thing of the past? Do you reckon Woolies and Coles are worried by these new apps that are popping up?
I definitely think they're on the radar, and we already know that some of those, you know, the big companies are partnering with other delivery companies, so they're trying to offer somewhat similar products. I mean, these startups are really focused on your inner CBD parts of Sydney and Melbourne, where people have fairly high incomes, young professionals, where time and convenience is critical. So I don't see it as facing a risk for the bigger brick and mortar companies, but it's definitely something that I think is going to be here for the longer term if they can get their business model and their employment relations models right.
And what about overseas? Are these things blowing up in other countries?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think we've seen them in Australia. So in parts of Europe, London, some of these companies are valued well over $1 billion. They're huge. They've got significant numbers of people working on them, tens of thousands. So basically what we're seeing in Australia sort of starting up in the last 12 months has been going on in parts of Europe and America for the better part of 2 years. So yeah, it's an evolutionary step in the gig economy.
Yeah, and Caleb, I mean, you're across the kind of whole sector, really. Broadly, do you reckon we're going to see some bigger reforms in the gig economy in the years ahead?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely pressure from, you know, some of the unions, the Transport Workers Union. We're seeing the Labor Party in opposition at the moment talking about reforming work and ensuring gig workers have some basic minimum standards. So the pressure around workers' conditions in particular, I think, is going to come become a big issue. And, you know, depending on how elections go, we might see some big changes in that space too.
That was Dr. Caleb Goods from the University of Western Australia there. That's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you next time.